DW Africa Link.
Are visa applications the new battlefield between Africa and Europe? The junta-run government in Niger has announced a new move restricting where Europeans can get visas to enter the Sahel country. They say Europeans will no longer be able to get visas in Niamey. Instead, they will need to travel to places like Geneva, Ankara, or even Moscow. So, where is this coming from? Well, the military government says it's only fair since Nigerians themselves have to leave their country to apply for European visas. But is this really about fairness? What does it mean for Niger's future and its ties with Europe? That's what's coming up. I am Eddie Micah Jr., and you are welcome to Africa Link, the podcast connecting you to the stories that matter.
Africa Link, every weekday, here on DW.
Since seizing power in 2023, Niger's junta has pursued nationalist politics and turned its back on Europe, especially France, its former colonial power. Relations got so bad that France's ambassador was expelled. Now, visas have entered the fight. Foreign Minister Bakary Sangari says Nigerians continue to travel to neighboring countries to complete the formalities of obtaining a visa. He complains that requests for European embassies in Niamey to issue visas locally were ignored. So the government is invoking reciprocity. The junta-led government says that moving on, citizens of Germany, Italy, Belgium, the UK and others must apply elsewhere. For more on this, let me bring in Bram Postumus. He is DW's correspondent in the Sahel region. I also have Beverly Ochieng, Senior Associate with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS. Hello and welcome to Africa Link. Bram, how are people in Niger reacting to this visa tit-for-tat? How did we even get here?
Well, I think the last bit of the question is a fairly easy one. You know, there was a coup a few years ago which removed President Bazoum, who had been elected by his the head of his presidential guard. And then, as is usual the case when there is a military coup, the question arose, now that we've got the power, what are we going to do with it? And this happened in an environment where there already had been coups in both Mali and in Burkina Faso, twice in both countries. And the rhetoric that was developed around these coups was a rhetoric that had to do with, we're newly sovereign, we are taking an anti-imperialist stance, we are no longer accepting the French lording it over us, and certainly not when it comes to security matters. And so the logical next step for the new junta in power in Niger was to latch onto the same rhetoric and engage in, a tug of war, if you like, with what's in inverted commas, its traditional partner. So the Americans were asked to leave. They were running a giant drone base over there. And then, obviously, also the French were asked to leave. What remained of Operation Barkhane in the Sahel was then asked to leave. And all this within the framework of, you know, we're taking an anti-imperialist stance. We're no longer accepting orders from Paris or Washington, for that matter. And so then the visa issue is a logical sequel to this. It's not only the fact that, you know, this anti-imperialist stance has been adopted, but also the fact that there has been widespread irritation on the entire African continent about how Europe behaves in terms of refusing visa to people who legitimately have reasons to be in Europe. There are numerous examples of this. But on the whole, you know, for ordinary Nigerian who don't have the wherewithal to travel, whose focus is mainly on doing business in your own country within the AES circles or indeed with the neighboring coastal states like Benin and Nigeria, the whole issue of visa is basically non-existent because, realistically speaking, they don't have the means and the wherewithal and the network to get to Europe in the first place. So to them, this whole tug of war about visa is something that basically doesn't really concern them.
Thank you very much, Bram, for laying that down. So, Beverly, yeah, seems like a bit of a tit for tat too, right? Because the government says it's applying a reciprocal principle. If Europeans make it hard for Nigerians to get visas, Niger will do the same. Does that make sense, Beverly?
I mean, in the view of the military government in Niger, it does. And it's not just Niger that's the unique situation. Other countries are thinking of applying similar rules because most African nationals do have to jump through lots of hoops to be able to get visas to go into Western countries, whether it's documentation, whether it's where you can do your biometric data. And then there's also a lot of arbitrary decision making, sometimes about family ties, it's about finances and various other things that in many instances, Western nationals never have to go through the same thing. So Niger is saying, for instance, that, you know, the embassies in Geneva, Ankara and Moscow will be the ones that will be giving European nationals visas, which means that anyone, if let's say you happen to be in Spain, you have to travel to one of these three countries to get a Nigerian visa. And in their view, it's a way of asserting sovereignty and a way of demonstrating that the same measures that Europe is using to apply to provide Nigerian nationals visas, the same measures that their government will be doing for Western nationals who are based in Europe obtaining visas in their country.
Right. Again, to put things into context, before the coup in 2023, Schengen visas could be obtained via France's consulate in Niamey. Now, many Nigerians must travel abroad, you know, countries like Burkina Faso, Mali, Nigeria even, just to apply. Obviously, EU-Niger ties have strained. That comes especially after the EU froze security and financial aid following the coup. But, Beverly, what really will this solve? It's not like it's going to benefit Niger in any way, is it?
It's more symbolic. And if you think about a lot of the diplomatic moves that Sahelian countries have been making, a lot of it is around the symbolism of being able to demonstrate that they can also have similar policies against Western nations. Of course, they are still in various ways disadvantaged because there is still the need for whether it's development aid, which is now increasingly dwindling due to strained relations with France and other EU countries, whether it's defense cooperation, which essentially collapsed after the military coup. And even though Niger has, as it says, diversified its partners, looking to Turkey, looking to China, looking to Russia, it still doesn't quite fill in the gap that was left after that sort of Western security infrastructure collapsed. So symbolically, and in terms of being able to shore up their nationalist pan-African bases for the military government, the messaging is more than enough. But of course, in terms of strategically, diplomatically, and being able to continue having a stronger and diverse support system for security, for humanitarian aid, and for other issues around social and diplomatic policies, it still does put them at a bit of a disadvantage, and it continues to strain relations, even considering the fact that after those tensions around June this year, there were some efforts by the EU to recalibrate its relationship with Niger. There had been the expulsion of an envoy. There had been some protest around comments made by the EU envoy about the impact of the flooding in Niger. So that recalibration might also still be on hold, which then means that any potential developmental, humanitarian, security aid that may have been coming from that recalibration is likely to take much longer, and Niger will still remain under considerable economic and humanitarian strain.
Right. Bram, so is this really about fairness and reciprocity, or is it more about Niger signaling a pivot toward Russia and new partners, as some experts seem to suggest?
That's not immediately easy to gauge, actually, because you have to unpack, you know, as Beverly also alludes to, the symbolism of the measures put in place on the one hand, and the actual, you know, contents of the policy that inform that symbolism, if you like. So whether there is a real pivot towards, say, new partners, I mean, that's actually, when you really consider it, it's nothing new. I mean, the oil industry that has been keeping, let's say that the Niger authorities, past and present, have been trying to set up an oil industry, which was by and large run by China, another partner that has come in, also because of its expertise and its size, is the state company Sonatra from Algeria, which has been engaged in oil-related activity in Niger. So how much of this is pragmatism? How much of this is a real pivot? How much of this is symbolism? These are things that you need to unpack. And I don't think there is a one-on-one explanation of why the junta in Niamey is behaving the way it does. There is definitely an element of, you know, Europe has been misbehaving towards citizens from African nations when it comes to visas. I mean, the hoops indeed you have to jump through in order to get documentation that allows you to get into Europe are absolutely astonishing and getting worse as well. And so in that sense, there is a real tit-for-tat reciprocity there. If you do this to us, we will do the same to you. That's quite easily explainable. But a lot of the other policies, you really have to unpack, okay, what is symbolism? What is pragmatism? What is a real, informed, fundamentally felt thing that needs to translate into policies? And that is something that needs a lot more study than we're currently having.
So let's highlight this a bit more, Bram. How could this shake up EU-Niger relations, especially when it comes to, you know, trade, aid and migration deals, for example?
Well, you know, if you talk about the relationship between the European Union and Niger, it has been by and large informed by what I always call the twin EU obsessions, which is migration and terrorism. Unfortunately, the two have been conflated in the minds of many politicians, in the minds of even policymakers who should know better, and indeed many, many parts of the electorate. So the whole EU policy towards not only Niger, but the Sahel at large and even the African continent has been more and more informed by fear of the other. How do we keep as many people out as possible? And how do we make life difficult for people who want to visit European countries for whatever reason? So, you know, in that sense, the whole attitude from Brussels towards countries like Niger has already given rise to a lot of irritation because people are not dumb, you know. It's the Europeans that need to really examine their attitudes towards people from the African continent if you want to bring this forward. That's where the origin of this problem lies, and it's not just visas. It's also, you know, the entire attitude of we know what's good for you, which is something that needs to fundamentally change.
Right. Thanks, Bram. So, Beverly, we're talking about three main junta-led countries in that region, right? Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger. Niger has made this move. I just want to find out how this move stacks up against what Mali and Burkina Faso have done to somehow distance themselves from Europe, if that's what they're trying to do.
Well, yeah, for the most part, there has been a rethinking within the three countries of their relationship with France as well as Western powers. For the start was the removal of French forces. So that started in Mali, and then you had Burkina Faso, and then you had Niger. And alongside that, what would have been a bigger European Union security infrastructure under the Takuba Task Force. The UN peacekeeping mission also left. And we've seen this paving the way or also allowing for the entry of both Russian paramilitaries in Mali, in Burkina Faso, and in Niger to some extent, as well as increased defense partnerships with China, with Turkey, and with other powers like Iran. There's not been as much in terms of robust visa policies by Burkina Faso or Mali, but then there has been this consolidation of an alliance that they're calling the Confederation of the Alliance of Sahel States, which has split from the economic community of West African states. They haven't yet imposed visas, but they are imposing things like import levies. So that separation is being seen not just symbolically, but through a structured approach with which they're putting in place mechanisms that they can consolidate a legitimate alliance and also use that to be able to renegotiate their relationship both with the regional and international community. And a lot of it is also underlying with anti-Western rhetoric. And this is not of, say, Russia or China's making. These are things that have existed over a long period of time when there was the sentiment that, for instance, French military support and intervention was not adequately responding to the militant crisis and its spread across the region. the feeling that that relationship was also quite paternalistic. Allegations that France was not taking into account or acknowledging, whether it's alleged abuses during colonialism or even afterwards. So all of these things have really shaken the ground for how these countries align themselves currently with both France as well as the European Union. And there's other concerns. The Nigerian military government, as soon as it came in, revoked the EU migrant deal.
Right. So, you know, these policies, if we want to call them that, they tend to be very popular across the African continent, right? Some see it as claiming back the power, right, over the West, as some would put it. But in this case, with these three junta-led countries, is it somehow more to just garner support while masking what is happening on the ground where these junta leaders are leading? I'll let you start, Beverly, on this.
I mean, I suppose it has become a fairly convenient counter-narrative. So it does take away from concerns around the level and extent of the insurgency, the spread of militant violence, concerns around allegations of human rights abuses, whether it's by defense forces or by other armed actors in the region. It is a way of trying to consolidate a support base that has been growing, that has lend legitimacy to governments that have obviously not been elected and took power through military coups and have tried to assert a sense of legitimacy among the public or within the public. It's also a way of co-opting some of those anti-Western, post-colonial narratives that are emerging. This is a very young population of people who are rethinking their own relationship with the West, who are speaking back at the West, who are taking back their own narratives. And for these military-led governments, it's a way of also resonating with that youth. But also it is leading to other shifts. If you look at what's happened, Namibia, for instance, introduced a reciprocal policy with US visa holders, putting in place a measure where they have to come in with visas. Some African countries are opening their borders to other African nations because intra-African travel is becoming extremely important, and accessing the region where, for instance, the West is shutting down means that Pan-African trade and inter-regional relations can improve. So it also depends on the dynamics. For the military governments, it will always be seen through the lens of anti-Western rhetoric to shore up their legitimacy. But I think broadly speaking, African countries are really rethinking how to improve intra-African trade where there are limitations coming, particularly from the West.
Okay. Bram, let me come to you on this. I'm sure you want to add something to this, but also mainly, is it working? The sort of focus on this anti-Western thing, is it working in terms of masking how the military rule or the junta leadership in these countries, the impact that they are having on their own countries? Or is there wide support for them in their own countries that they lead?
Now, there's a couple of things to unpack here, I think. I mean, first of all, what's happening in the three military-led countries that we're discussing today fits in a wider trend. You know, the whole turning away from the West and from Europe, it's, for instance, in the way commerce is being done, trade is being done, has been going on for a while. I mean, China has been overtaking most, if not all, European nations and even the EU collectively as Africa's most important trading partner. That predates the coups by years and years and years. So that's one thing. The other thing is the rhetoric is obviously indeed conveniently hiding the fact that the juntas are not performing according to their own promises. I mean, when Ibrahim Traoré took power, he said, within 6 months, I will have this sorted out. This is obviously not happening, and the problem is getting worse. We've just had another village attacked in the north of Cote d'Ivoire over the weekend, which was the first attack in, I think, 4 years or 3 years, if memory serves. And this is a signal also that things are not quite right on the other side of the border in Burkina Faso, or indeed Mali for that matter. As we all know, is that journalists have been targeted in all three countries. The space for gathering information independently is virtually non-existent and can land you in some very serious trouble. There's a lot of colleagues, journalists, who have either self-exiled or have gone underground or have changed profession altogether So it makes it a lot easier for the juntas to continue their narrative through the media they control, because those are the only media now available in the countries themselves. How much that translates into actual support on the ground, I think there is probably two trends. Number one, there is absolutely support for the juntas in the countries, especially among the young, who have seen the failure of what we call democracy in delivering security, in delivering economic prosperity, in delivering a better outlook on a better life in the future, none of which has materialized under the previous dispensation. So as far as they are concerned, they're not looking at an anti-constitutional coup d'etat through military means. They're looking at a different way to govern their countries and their lives, and perhaps open other opportunities that weren't available beforehand. So that's a different perspective. Whether that's going to hold is another question, because the longer the juntas go on, and they've now all pretty much promised themselves to rule for the next 5 years, if not indefinitely.
Right.
At some point, they will have to deliver. And this is where the crucial issue comes in. Deliver in terms of economic prospects, deliver in terms of security, whereas the situation on the ground is demonstrably getting worse, both in Burkina and in Mali, and arguably also in Niger. And so that is where the litmus test will be. But that is not now, not even next year. That's going to be a bit further into the future.
Beverly, as we try to wrap this, and just to highlight, Bram, with his statement, ending statements, seems to suggest that the situation in these three junta-led countries, Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, that it's, as it stands, gotten worse than before the military coup, which obviously is going to be a big challenge. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. But also, with all that's going on, are we witnessing a bigger geopolitical realignment with what these three junta leaders are trying to do?
There are various indicators that things are not likely to improve within the short term. So one is the rate and pace of the insurgency. Even though Ouagadougou, that's in Burkina Faso, and that central region remain quite well away from the violence, there has been quite a shift in the front lines, particularly in the north coming down and the east moving more westwards. And then in Niger, the risk towards Tillaberi, which is where the capital sits. And in Mali, there has been the spate of attacks in the more economic zones, which is the south and the western parts of the country. And that is a potential risk to not just the economic infrastructure, but even the legitimacy of the military leadership in terms of being able to steer the country taking place there.
Right. Only time will tell how it plays out. But Bram, where do we go from here? Where does this leave things? What do you project is going to be the situation, you know, when it comes to these three junta-led countries and their relations with the rest of the world as we wrap this up?
My goodness, I don't have a crystal ball, I have to tell you. First of all, when the military juntas tell you that they have every intention to remain in power for at least the foreseeable future, believe them. That's exactly what they're going to do.
Very well noted. I have learned a lot from this discussion, and I'm sure listeners have too. Bram Postumus, DW's correspondent in the Sahel region, thank you very much. Also, Beverly Ocheng, Senior Associate with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, thank you.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
The junta insists that this is a move based on reciprocity, a principle in diplomacy where one side mirrors the treatment it receives. But no doubt, visa restrictions are straining an already fragile relationship. Since the coup, Niamey has drawn closer to Russia, Turkey, Iran, and China, partners who don't lecture it on democracy. Meanwhile, Europe sees the visa move as a provocation and part of a larger pattern in the Sahel, where juntas in Mali and Burkina Faso have also cut ties with the West. Experts say to avoid escalation and keep people connected, dialogue is key. What do you think? Kindly share your thoughts with us on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Listen to us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to click follow and subscribe to our DW Africa YouTube channel so you never miss an episode. This show was co-produced and edited by Isaac Mugabe, and I am Eddie Micah Jr. Thanks for listening.
DW, made for minds.